Welcome to War Room, the official podcast of the U.S. Army War College Online Journal, graciously supported by the Army War College Foundation. Please join the conversation at warroom.armywarcollege.edu. We hope you enjoy the program.
You can subscribe to A Better Peace, the War Room podcast, at iTunes, Google Play, or your favorite download service, and never miss the great content we offer.
Hello, and welcome to A Better Peace, the War Room podcast. I'm Jacqueline Witt, professor of strategy at the U.S. Army War College, and the editor for A Better Peace. Thanks for joining us today. Since its founding, West Point has graduated and commissioned young officers who later become some of the most senior leaders in the U.S. Army. In 1829, 46 young men comprised the graduating class. For this cohort, their varied experiences in the Second Seminole War and the Mexican War fundamentally shaped how they understood war, and their attitude toward using war to advance policy. I'm joined today by Dr. Paul Springer, who is the chair of the Department of Research at the Air Command and Staff College in Montgomery, Alabama, and he's working on a collective biography of these officers and argues that the modern American military might look to this class to understand how experiences shape the professional and intellectual development of officers. Paul is the author of Brothers in Peace and War, the West Point Class of 1829, and his historical research in this case focuses on the 19th century United States. So, Paul, thanks for joining me at the War Room.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
It's a pleasure. So, just start off with this idea of a collective biography. Tell us about the class of 1829 at West Point.
The individuals that are most well known from this class would be Robert E. Lee and Joseph E. Johnston, both of whom rose to prominence, obviously, in the Confederate Army during the Civil War. But there's a whole host of other interesting characters that were really central to the intellectual and social and cultural and economic development of the United States in the mid-19th century. About half of the class pursued full military careers, and about half of the class actually pursued other endeavors, and they became some of the most well-known leading lights in their fields over the course of several decades of experience.
So when you say that some of them sort of entered other fields, what kind of other things did they do?
Well, the top graduate of the class, Charles Mason, actually became a lawyer only 2 years after graduating from West Point. He wound up becoming one of the territorial Supreme Court justices of Wisconsin. He then moved to Iowa, where he became the Chief Justice of the Iowa Territory, wrote the State Code of Iowa, became the U.S. Commissioner of Patents, founded a railroad, and had plenty of time also to engage in his own farming endeavors. There were other individuals that became prominent faculty members at different schools that became, we had one that was one of the most well-known painters of the 19th century, Seth Eastman. There were pioneers that paved the pathways to the western coast. So I had individuals that essentially went off on their own and founded entire cities in the west. We also had individuals that became very well-known engineers and were responsible for some of the major infrastructure projects of the day.
So we really see West Point as a sort of incubator for an elite segment of American society who are going to go off and do all manner of things. And then we also have, like you said, a number who stay in the Army. Can you tell us a little bit about what the Army is like in when these guys graduate?
So the Army is characterized by promotions via seniority, extremely long time spent as lieutenants and captains. The vast majority of these individuals will spend almost 10 years before they become a captain, and they might very well spend another 15 to 20 years as a captain before an opportunity arises for promotion. In the 19th century, it was entirely common for people to stay in the Army until they died, and one could not be promoted until there was space above them. And because those promotions were almost entirely based on seniority, you could actually have a commander that might not have actually been near troops for 15 or 20 mm-hmm. years, but who still soaked up the highest ranks.
So this is quite different, right, from the sort of up or out rapid sort of move through junior ranks. So this is in part why we see Robert E. Lee as a colonel, right?
Robert E. Lee will actually make the rank of colonel right before the Civil War starts. And quite frankly, at a number of times in his career, he debates getting out of the Army to pursue other interests. In particular, his colonelcy takes him to the middle of nowhere, Texas. And while he's there, he's away from his family. He shows a lot of signs of depression. He writes a lot of letters and really bears his soul to the people he's communicating mm-hmm. with. It's clear that as far as he's concerned, his career has run its course. Robert E. Lee, in a lot of ways, feels like a failure in the late 1850s. A lot of his classmates, a lot of his colleagues had gone on and done what he saw as being more important or exciting or useful things for the country. In particular, one of his best friends was Joseph E. Johnston. But Johnston, despite graduating lower in the class, had managed to advance in rank more quickly due to essentially both circumstance and a willingness to ruthlessly pursue his own advancement. So Johnston, by 1860, is one of the few brigadier generals in the United States Army. And in a lot of ways, that seems to rankle Lee despite their longstanding mm-hmm. friendship.
So when we talk about the Army, so there's a different personnel system. Like you said, there's a sense that his sort of careers maybe have run their course, that they take a long time. What kind of activities, though, is the Army involved in between 1829 and the start of the American Civil War?
So the United States is essentially in conflict from 1829 all the way through the end of the Civil War, and arguably well beyond that. The West Point class of 1829 gets its first opportunity for what we might consider a significant conflict in the Black Hawk War of 1832. A handful of the individuals are actually involved in that particular fight. And the Black Hawk War is a really nasty, overlooked war in American history. It happens to coincide with a major cholera outbreak that's actually going to kill at least one of my graduates and possibly as many as three. There are two that died contemporaneously that their means of death was not
unclear.
Properly recorded. We know for sure at least one of them died on the Great Lakes on a steam vessel that was carrying Winfield Scott to the seat of the war. And he was actually literally dumped into the lake, weighted down, and left behind. After the Black Hawk War, the large portion of this particular class is going to get involved in the Seminole War in Florida. The individuals that participate in that Seminole War wind up being very deeply scarred by it. A lot of my class actually resigns their commissions, either as a result of serving in Florida or to avoid being sent to Florida. This is a major source of officer attrition. But some of the most prominent members of the class never set foot in Florida during the Seminole Wars, and so they're not heavily influenced by this type of conflict, which is characterized by ambushes, by guerrilla fighting, by heavy casualties, and no significant source of progress. Robert E. Lee, for example, is actually busy as an engineer. He's upgrading fortifications. He's helping to essentially streamline the flow of the Des Moines River. He's nowhere near this conflict. And he feels it very strongly. He feels like he's missing out on his opportunity for glory and possibly battlefield brevet promotions. When Mexico occurs, Robert E. Lee can't wait to get involved in the fight. And if that means he has to transfer out of his beloved engineering branch in order to get a combat mm-hmm. opportunity, he will. As it turns out, both Zachary Taylor and Winfield Scott are going to effectively use their engineering personnel in the same fashion that we might think of special forces today. Reconnaissance patrols, seeking opportunities to essentially leverage the countryside, ways that they can potentially bypass enemy strong points. And so Robert E. Lee is going to rise to prominence very quickly through his temerity and honestly just through his hard efforts. At one point, Lee is actually going to be awake and engaged in conflict or reconnaissance for almost 72 hours straight. He actually faints from the saddle and has to be carried away to a tent. But about 8 hours later, he's back up and out and once again engaging in activity.
So those are two really different circumstances and kinds of wars that West Point graduates sort of find themselves in. One, deeply frustrating, not a lot of progress, frustration about political aims, difficult combat, and then another place where people are rising to prominence in a war has different public support, different political objectives, different political ends. So can you talk a little bit about how, if people serve in one or the other, I don't know if there are people who serve in both, how those experiences then shape how they approach the Army and how they approach military the use of military power.
Sure. The Seminole War happens earlier in their careers, and so the individuals that are serving there are in their late 20s to early 30s. By the time Mexico breaks out, the vast majority of them are in their late 30s and even early 40s. So there are formative aspects that temporally are important. But Mexico is characterized by large-scale, by the United States standards, battles, open conflicts, and quite frankly, aggression. The smaller American army tends to win its battles in Mexico. According to Scott, it actually wins every battle that it fought. And it tends to do so by essentially deliberately attacking against a numerically superior foe. That is going to heavily influence individuals that command in the Civil War. So Robert E. Lee sees that if you seize the offensive and go charging headlong against the enemy, you might drive them before you, even if they outnumber you. Not coincidentally, the Confederacy is going to be significantly outnumbered, but Lee has internalized this as the mechanic of how to win the 19th
century
wars. We're going to
see that come back, right?
Very much so. But in the Seminole War, the Americans are actually the numerically superior of the two forces, and they're losing almost constantly. And so for the individuals that Mexico is the first opportunity to see conflict, they draw radically different lessons, which are really going to be horrific for the Confederacy. Joseph E. Johnston is kind of the exception to that rule. He had a little bit of service in the Seminole War, though technically he had resigned his commission for a couple months. So he actually saw service in both. He got shot in both. And as a result, Johnston is a little more cautious as a commander, in part because he's afraid of what might be over the hill or behind the forest. Lee
seems
to be almost reckless.
He's maybe learned a broader sort of lesson
from his
experience. When we think about how this cohort, and you talked a little bit about the Confederacy and how it learns lessons and how these officers take their experiences with them, do we see differences in how the Confederacy and how the Union is going to manage experience and I guess now we'd call it talent management. That's the buzzword that we would use now. Do they manage this differently?
What people need to remember is that Winfield Scott was the general-in-chief of the army for most of the Civil War, technically. He has an enormous influence, even though he's not actually directing anything. And Winfield Scott is a firm believer that it's the youth, the lieutenants and captains, that will be the deciding factor in the Civil War. He understands that there's really nobody in the United States that has any experience directing large bodies of troops, with the possible exception of himself. And so he thinks that the North is going to do well to rely upon young people that are more adaptable, that are more capable. Whereas the Confederacy, which is under Jefferson Davis, previous Secretary of War, and West Point class of 1828, is much more characterized by a cautious approach when it comes to the selection of military command. Jefferson Davis is effectively personally choosing all of the individuals that he wants to be part of his war effort, and he's picking people that he knew from West Point, even if they're completely incompetent in the field. One of his best friends is from the West Point class of 1829, Theophilus Holmes. Holmes knows full well that he is completely incapable of a significant field command, and he protests that fact to Jefferson Davis on a regular basis. Davis thinks that he's just being really humble. And so
Every time
Theophilus Holmes effectively says, please don't give me that command, Jefferson Davis promotes him and puts him in an area of greater responsibility with disastrous results. And Holmes knows full well this is a bad idea, but he can't seem to bring himself to simply resign his command. Davis is far more interested in those personal relationships and personal loyalty than he seems to be in terms of winning the war. He just can't seem to grasp that these are not the commanders that can win.
Did Davis have other, were there other options? Were there other things he could have pursued? Or was there a sense that these are the only choices that he has in front of him?
Davis, yes, he definitely had other options. There were other commanders. Joseph E. Johnston and Jefferson Davis hated each other at West Point, and it never stopped. There is a lot of evidence to suggest the two of them had actually gotten in a physical fight over a young lady at West Point. And even during the Civil War, that rancor that exists between the two of them never goes away. You can see it in their letters to each other. Davis is constantly looking for an excuse to remove Johnston. And Robert E. Lee and others are standing up for Johnston and saying, no, you need to keep this guy in position. He knows what he's doing. He knows how to lead. Mm-hmm. But Johnston is far more cautious than Davis would prefer. Davis also has internalized those lessons of the Mexican War and thinks the best path to victory is invasion and aggression and attack. And as a result, he's basically squandering his personnel by picking the most aggressive commanders he can find. For example, Johnston gets removed from command trying to defend Atlanta from Sherman's advances, and Davis picks a commander that he knows will go on the offensive, John Bell Hood. Predictably, Hood does exactly what Davis expected, launches an attack, and destroys his own army in the process.
Doesn't turn out well for them. So in the North, you said they're focusing more on these junior leaders, junior officers, but clearly the Army of the United States has to have senior commanders. They have and they go through a lot, right? So how do we understand that process sort of in relationship to the West Point training, previous experience, and things like that?
You have hundreds of West Point graduates that are potentially available for service. And they're not the only people that you could put into these commands. Obviously, there's a lot of political generals. There are a lot of individuals that are holdovers that had never been at West Point. But Abraham Lincoln seems to be far more willing to experiment. He's far more willing to essentially base things on merit and performance rather than simply choosing on the basis of loyalty. And I would argue that that's partially due to Lincoln's own personal experience when it comes to conflict. The only real war that Lincoln was associated with was the Black Hawk War. He was elected as a captain of militia, and he characterized it as more of a war on mosquitoes than anything else. He and his troops marched around, never saw any conflict, never saw any hardship. An interesting side note, though, is that Lincoln was actually sworn into federal service by a young lieutenant from the West Point class of 1828, Jefferson Davis. Both of them wrote about it later in life when they realized how they had met before. But because Lincoln is not convinced that he's the foremost strategist of the Union, he's actually willing to keep experimenting with different mm-hmm. commanders. And those that perform well are rewarded not on the basis of personal loyalty, but rather on the basis of how well they accomplished their objectives. And so as a result, Lincoln has a much more rational strategy when it comes to selecting commanders and interacting with the key military leaders that are fighting for his cause.
Sure. So we've talked in a couple of different ways about how the 19th century army is different from the 21st century army. But I think one of the things that is important for contemporary military professionals and leaders to think about is how examples from the past, how historical cases can help us think about contemporary problems. And so can you speculate a little bit or help our audience think about how contemporary folks might look at the USMA class of 1829 to ask the right questions, identify themes or problems or ideas?
Well, when you think about what it means to lead in the military, in many ways it hasn't fundamentally changed. The mechanisms might be the same, but at the end of the day, you're trying to take care of your people and you're trying to accomplish a mission. And regardless of who those people are and what that mission is, you still need to take into account the capabilities, the preferences, and all of the aspects of the personnel that you're working with. The servant leader model has really proven to be very effective. And in the West Point class of 1829, a lot of these individuals internalized the idea that if one takes care of the people under their leadership, under their command, the results will be phenomenal. And the individuals that never internalized that concept, that were more interested in their own advancement, more interested in their own glory, they did not wind up being the individuals that led, that rose to command. They tended to fall away. Mm-hmm. And so I think in the 21st century, most of the fundamentals of how to organize teams and be successful have not changed. You still need to focus on the people that are associated with the mission.
Absolutely. When we think about at the sort of enterprise level, at the talent management level, managing a class of 46 is going to be different from managing a graduating class of over 1,000 plus direct commissions and ROTC. So how do we, in the 21st century, think about merit? How do we think about moving the right people into the right jobs at the right moments?
Yeah, I don't have a great solution for how to make sure that we do.
If you did, we might have different jobs.
It would be handy. It would be helpful. But the reality is, I don't have a cookie cutter answer, and I don't know that that's what you're really going for. But I don't have a solution for talent management writ large, other than to say the most important thing we can do is assess individuals as individuals. And we often have a drive to try to massage data and try to compare individuals with vastly different backgrounds, aptitudes, experiences, and capabilities. Maybe that's not the best approach. Maybe we shouldn't centralize every aspect of personnel management, and maybe we shouldn't be looking to move people from line to staff to line to staff to new positions every 2 years. The West Point class of 1829 is characterized by long periods of service in the same types of roles and becoming absolute experts at their jobs. And as a result, it's an extremely efficient approach. The Army of the 19th century has very deep funding problems. It is a very small army with an enormous mission, and yet it manages for the most part to accomplish that mission through efficiency and effectiveness, which is largely driven by individuals being allowed to flourish in their roles and to maintain those roles for long periods of time. And I feel like sometimes in the officer management program of the 21st century, we're so worried about where somebody's going to be in 20 or 30 years that we're forgetting to focus on where they are right now.
And people holding jobs for 18 months, sometimes even less, and feeling like there's never time to develop that that expertise. One other thing that strikes me is this difference between service in the Second Seminole War and the Mexican War, and how that shapes, like you said, the intellectual and professional development. And I think right now in the military and the Army in particular, you're starting to see sort of two cohorts emerge. There is a cohort who were junior officers in the early days of Afghanistan and Iraq and the global war on terror. And after 2012, 2013, you have a cohort of junior officers whose company grade experience is vastly different from those who deployed pretty consistently in the early 2000s. Do you see ways to maybe reconcile or to mitigate the gap in experiences as we think about intellectual and professional development for the U.S. Army?
That's a great question. And quite frankly, I think in many ways, the best way that we can reconcile those differences is substantial interaction. The more relationships you can establish between the different cohorts, the different generations, one-on-one mentoring and advising and assisting and complementing each other. I also think education is the great leveler. And by education, I always want to draw the distinction between education, learning for the sake of learning, and training one's ability to think and communicate about difficult problems from training, which was, you know, for me, is always about learning the professional aspects of behavior associated with one's position. I think that the Army, like the other services, needs to maintain a strong emphasis on the education of its officers, because we never know what's going to come in the future. But we do know the more educated someone is, the more likely they are to be able to react effectively to the unexpected. And so the more that we can spend time, and it does take time, educating our individuals, the better off they're going to be for the unforeseen challenges of the future.
And allowing them really to talk to each other, to learn from each other, and to develop those relationships that may come into play later on. Paul, thanks so much for coming and talking with us about the West Point class of 1829. Several classes since then have gone on to do different things and good things for the United States. It's been a pleasure talking with you today.
Thank you for the opportunity.
And that concludes our program. Thank you for listening. The views expressed in this podcast reflect those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views, policies, or positions of the U.S. Army or the Department of Defense. Let us know what you think. Provide us your feedback, comments, or suggestions through our webpage at warroom.armywarcollege.edu. And have a great day.